There was definitely ancient ruins in Mexico City in my mission. There was pyramids of Teotihuacan, and it was very, very cool experience to go there and see the pyramids. And just when I looked at it, all I could think was Book of Mormon every time I saw it. I mean, you had the sun pyramid, the moon pyramid, and then didn't really say anything about the stars, but it was there.
No, it wasn't.
And then when you went to the Quetzalcoatl pyramid, there was the Quetzalcoatl pyramid in the middle, and there was like this kind of like amphitheater, and then raised up, there was 12 little pyramids around the side, and on the back there was three. And I thought that was kind of interesting how that was set up, and I just saw Book of Mormon all over that, and it was really neat to see that, and that there was ancient people there, and the Book of Mormon does testify of that, and it was so neat to see that. I'd recommend it to anyone that goes there and to go see that on a P-Day, or if you're just going to Mexico City, just to go see that, because it is amazing to see these pyramids, so.
Yeah, that sounds amazing, and I'm in Mexico right now, so I'm just going to head on out there. Why don't you come on?
This is Infants on Thrones, philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and the sounds you're hearing right now in the background are the vendors at the base of the Temple of the Sun in Teotihuacan. I recorded this myself because I came to Mexico City for business and I had some time to go and visit the pyramids, and I got to climb up to the Temple of the Sun and walk down the Avenue of the Dead and stand in the courtyard at the base of the Temple of the Moon. And you know what? Just like this random missionary kid that I found on YouTube, I also couldn't help but think Book of Mormon everywhere I looked. Except for me, it was probably a little different. But, you know, for me, growing up, seeing all these pictures of Jesus coming down and walking among the Nephites, you know, I'd seen all these Mesoamerican temples and ruins and architecture. And then here I was, standing in the courtyard that, as far as I could tell, was the very inspiration for some of those Book of Mormon pictures. And it just seemed so stupid. Now, on this trip, I've been reading Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet by John Turner. I'm only about 100 pages into it, but it's put my mind back into early Mormon church mode. You know, it was such a different experience for those guys, and the world was such a different place, too. Now, I was really interested as I read the sections about Zion's camp. You know, the way these guys trekked from Ohio to Missouri, and you know, they came across all these Native American mounds, and Joseph Smith would take opportunity to play ancient American tour guide and tell all these guys detailed stories about the mounds and how they tied back to the Nephites, which was further evidence of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, which was further evidence of his own divine calling. Nothing self-serving there. And a pretty important tactic, I think, to pull out when you're trying to convince these guys to just keep on marching. So we have this one really good example of what some of these tour guide stories must have been like, because at one point they found a dried skeleton with an arrow through it, and Joseph Smith told them that this was Zelph, a white Lamanite warrior who lived under the reign of the prophet Onondagas and fought alongside Onondagas for the cause of freedom. Yay! And Brigham Young was so impressed that he took the arrow from the bones and he kept it as a souvenir. I didn't know that. And it was a reminder to him throughout his life of the truthfulness of Joseph Smith. And then there was this time, a few years after Zion's March, when they found this stone pillar that looked like an altar. And Joseph told everyone that it had been built by Adam himself. You know, amazing that those rocks would stay on top of each other for so long, especially withstanding all the water damage that they must have sustained in the flood. And Joseph named this place Adam on Diamond. And he said that it was where Adam and Eve lived after they had been kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Because Joseph Smith was kind of like that Paul Harvey guy on AM radio that my dad used to listen to. You know, the one that always ended his shows with,
now you know.
the rest of the story. Yeah, Joseph Smith loved giving people this inside rest of the story crap about the Bible and Book of Mormon stories. And those people just ate it up. And many of my own ancestors just ate it up. You know, sometimes I wonder what was wrong with them. And then I wonder what's wrong with me for wondering what was wrong with them. So, as I walked through these very impressive structures at Teotihuacan, I imagined what it would have been like if I was walking there with Joseph Smith as my tour guide. And this sort of Cliff Clavin-type voice popped into my head.
Isn't that a quirk in the Clavin family that we all have two extra teeth? You see, that's the only way that we can prove that we are the rightful heirs to the Russian throne.
Hello in there, Cliff. Tell me, what color is the sky in your world?
And it was saying these things like, yeah, this is the Temple of the Sun, where the Black Nephite Sambo Wamboha stood to warn all the people of the city of the impending Kurilam attack. Yeah, that's it. And you see that mural over there, the jaguar? Well, yeah, people think that it was jaguars, but back then it was really Kurilams. Yeah, Kurilams were hunted and completely wiped out, and their skins were traded for precious ores. Yeah, shiny precious ores, kind of like the ones those vendors are selling right over there. Yeah, that's the ticket. Because you know what I think really happened? I think that Joseph Smith knew about these pyramids in Central America. I mean, of course he knew about these pyramids in Central America. And he knew they were these amazingly mysterious structures that, you know, most people just associated with Egyptian and Egyptian pyramids. So Egyptian pyramids and Central American pyramids, there must be some old world connection to the new world. So let's tell the rest of the story. And let's tell about how they got there. You know, people will like that, right? So, okay, yeah. I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents and all that, do now make a record in the language of my fathers, which consists of the learning of the Jews, because we need that to connect these people to the Bible and all those cool stories, right? And, of course, the language of the Egyptians, you know, because of that whole old world pyramid connection thing. And, yeah. We've got all these ancient Indian mounds up here, you know, the ones that I've been taking people to for years as we look for gold and stuff. So what if the same group that started in the old world came to the new world and built the pyramids, and then they moved up into the northern parts of America and also built these big mounds right up here? I mean, over time, of course. And then they left a written history on golden plates right here where I can find them and tell the whole rest of the story. Yeah, that makes sense, right? So before I visited the pyramids here in Mexico, I sent an email to the other guys just kind of jokingly saying, hey, I'm going to Zarahemla, wish me luck. And Tom sent me a link to this guy named Ryan Fisher. He's some kind of Nephite explorer. I don't know. I guess he calls himself the Indiana Jones of Book of Mormon geography or something.
My name is Ryan Fisher. I'm an investigative journalist and explorer, and I'm applying the tools of my trade to all things Nephite. I'm launching into a series of investigations into Nephite archaeology, scriptural history, and prophecies about latter-day America. This is Nephite Explorer.
Now, there was a time in my life where I thought that maybe I could do something like this. You know, I was studying cultural anthropology, folklore, and I was focusing on Mormon culture, and I thought that maybe someday I'd be able to teach at BYU and get to apply my own tools of the trade to all things Mormon, which would include some modern-day nibbly stuff, you know, making connections between modern beliefs and ancient traditions that would validate the beliefs and show us all how right we are, as if we didn't already know that already, right? But it doesn't really work like that. At least, it didn't for me.
The Book of Mormon is a volume of scripture that, among other teachings of Jesus Christ, contains many prophecies about the promised land of the Nephites. Prophecies that are directed to the people that will one day live on that same promised land that the Nephites were destroyed on. These are prophecies not to be taken lightly. They are warnings of great natural disasters, wars, maintaining freedom, and more. Taking into consideration the great responsibility of the people and government of that promised land, I want to know exactly where is the Promised Land in these latter days. Do these prophecies apply to the United States, Canada, Mexico? Is it North America? Is
it... See, I couldn't get away with stuff like this in grad school. I couldn't just say the Book of Mormon is scripture and contains the teachings of Jesus Christ. I wanted to. I believed it. But I couldn't just put it out there like that without giving any evidence that it really was what I thought it was. And it would have to be evidence that an outsider would accept or at least consider valid. So, you know, Ryan's approach here is that the Book of Mormon says some pretty important things about the future inhabitants of this land. So we better be really clear about where this land actually is. My interest would have been whether or not the things in this land could truly provide valid evidence of the Book of Mormon. So my approach would be to validate the Book of Mormon first, and Ryan's just taking this as a given. But I would want to know what a non-Mormon specialist would say about archaeological evidence for the Book of Mormon. You know, a guy like Yale professor Michael Coe.
Nobody ever used iron in the New World. Nobody has ever found pre-Columbian coinage, ever. If there were coins, there'd be chocolate beans. Why aren't chocolate beans mentioned in the Book of Mormon? Copper alloys like brass in any form doesn't show up in Mesoamerica until at the earliest 800 AD. Gold doesn't show up in any way until 700 or 800 AD. You've got crops mentioned in the Book of Mormon that never existed in pre-Columbian America. All of these things would have produced pollen if they'd been grown by anybody. A lot of this stuff is wind-blown. It would fall onto ponds and lakes and get enclosed in sediments. Tremendous amounts of pollen work has been done in this area, in Mesoamerica. We find ancient pollen, and there's none of this stuff that's in the Book of Mormon. Silk, nothing. The seven-day calendar was unknown. They never had chariots. They had helmets, all right, but they weren't made out of brass, that's for sure. There's no evidence for horses, no evidence whatsoever for any kind of cattle. Pig, zero. Not one pig bone has ever shown up. Elephants, there's nothing. I've never seen anything there that would convince me that these people have Middle Eastern DNA. We can read 95% of what the Maya themselves wrote. It's in Maya. It's not in Aramaic. It's not Semitic. There are no Semitic words whatsoever in it. It's got no relation whatsoever with any languages that we know of in the Old World. Basically, if you're looking for Old World connections and looking at the Near East, you're looking in the wrong place.
Okay. That's pretty discouraging. So maybe the Book of Mormon isn't exactly what it claims to be. I mean, now if I'm a grad student and I'm really serious about trying to learn how to use these tools of the trade, I need to actually be open to what the evidence is telling me, right? I guess I also need to be open to hearing other explanations. So, all right, let's go back to Ryan. What does Ryan have to say about this land? Because, you know, Coe was talking about Mesoamerica as being this land, but maybe Joseph Smith had some other land in mind.
In my quest to better understand the events of the Book of Mormon and where they took place, I'm going back in church history to find out more about the man that knew the Nephites the most, Joseph Smith.
Right, because he made up the Nephites. Okay, I'll shut up.
On June 4th, 1834, in his own handwriting, he wrote, "We arrived this morning on the banks of the Mississippi River. We left the eastern part of Ohio. The whole of our journey in the midst of so large a company of social, honest, and sincere men, wandering over the plains of the Nephites, recounting occasionally the history of the Book of Mormon, roving over the mounds of that once beloved people of the Lord, picking up their skulls and bones as proof of its divine authenticity."
He's talking about Zelph, by the way.
This letter is in the possession of the RLDS Church here in Nauvoo, now known as the Community of Christ. And that is why it's not known to many scholars. But in it, Joseph Smith tells his wife, Emma, about roving over the plains of the Nephites with astounding detail.
So clearly, Joseph believed that the people who built the mounds that he was around were the Nephite people. That's obvious to everyone, right?
We know from modern archaeology that there is a culture here in the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys called the Hopewell. They're also known as the Mound Builders.
What mounds was Joseph Smith talking about? This letter was written during Zion's Camp March, which started in Kirkland, Ohio, May 4, 1834, and concluded on the banks of the Mississippi River a month later. Somewhere along this route, Joseph Smith and company encountered the mounds and remains of what he called proof of the Book of Mormon's divine authenticity. I'm setting off to try and find those mounds and gather any archaeological evidence that would support Joseph Smith's claims.
Now that would be really cool, right? You know, evidence to support Joseph Smith's claims? I would actually really like that. But let's not forget, Joseph Smith knew about these mounds long before the Book of Mormon was published. So if he actually was the author of the Book of Mormon and he was trying to tell the rest of the story about the origin of these mounds, then the evidence that we find better be pretty solid, because if it's just something lame like, and in the Book of Alma we have an account of Helaman throwing up mounds of dirt for fortification, and look, here's mounds of dirt, just like the Book of Mormon said there would be. Yeah, if it's something lame like that, then it isn't really evidence.
Okay, I'm in Newark, Ohio, and there are just absolutely massive earthworks here. Circles, octagons, just everything on a scale that I had no idea existed. I mean, look at this.
Okay, yeah, impressive earth mounds, absolutely. But all these shapes prove what? That the people who built them were creative? Okay, lots of ancient people built lots of amazing things pretty much everywhere around the world. So where exactly is the Book of Mormon, Ty?
I'm standing on this wall right now that is about 25 feet high. It's a massive ditch. It must have taken just absolutely massive amounts of man hours and manpower to build this structure.
Wow, that sounds massive. But, okay, so how does this have to do with the Book of Mormon?
Meeting me here is Wayne May, publisher of Ancient American Magazine and Mormon convert. Wayne has amassed volumes of research and understanding on the Hopewell people, who have many direct parallels to the Nephite nation.
Ooh, many. I like that word.
Here we are, this very blustery fall day. This is the Great Circle in Ohio, which is part of the Newark Earthworks. The Newark Earthworks totally comprises about a 4.5 area of miles in circumference. But this was built by, as far as we know, the Hopewell people, 300 B.C. to 400 A.D., and it's a magnificent structure. It makes it unusual because the ditch is on the inside, and so rather than be a fortification like so many of them are, we really believe this one had definitely ceremonial or a sacred purpose.
Why? I mean, like a ditch on the inside of the wall has a religious or ceremonial purpose, okay, because of like the law of Moses that tells you to have a ditch inside the wall, or like, what's the religious significance of a ditch inside the wall? I hope we go into this.
Let's take a walk up here on top of the berm so you can see how high these things are. As you can begin to see here and appreciate the depth of this place and the largeness of it is absolutely huge.
He's not going to say anything about the religious stuff and make a connection, is he? He's just impressed by how big it is still.
This circle runs approximately 154 feet all the way across in the center for the diameter. The circle itself is almost a true circle within about a foot and a half of 18 inches of difference. Otherwise, it is very, very perfect. And again, it's just so huge. You can't hardly appreciate how big it is. The only way to really see this is to take it from the air, from an airplane, and look down upon this and see the magnificence and how big this is.
Oh, please, please stop.
If the massive sheer scale of this earthworks aren't impressive enough.
Well, they are, but it doesn't tie anything to the Nephites. I mean, come on, get to it.
Get this. They all have astronomical alignments. Equinox, winter solstice, summer solstice, moonrise, sunset. I mean, all this stuff is planned out into the lines that make this earthwork.
Yeah, right. So is Stonehenge. I mean, like, that's what ancient people did. They lived by the seasons. They planted crops at a certain time. They harvested them at a certain time. They needed to know what all this stuff was. But, like, this is a Book of Mormon connection? I don't know. I don't know. What are you saying to me?
I mean, we're talking about astronomy and math that's way beyond me.
Oh, please, please just get to all of these many, many parallels. Please, please do it. Please, please.
What context are we talking about here in relationship to the account of the Lehites and their people?
Thank you, thank you. And nicely said.
The whole Polar Earthworks represents, as you can see if you read in the Book of Alma, starting at 72 BC, when Moroni decided he would fortify all the lands and all the earth, he said he would throw up great banks of earth and dig deep ditches. And this is representative of these great banks of earth and deep ditches. And these are representative of the fortifications in the Promised Land, which has a nice parallel and match here in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois.
Okay, to be fair, I knew this was coming. But seriously, lame.
I can imagine this being quite effective at repelling a Lamanite attack.
For students of the Book of Mormon, just try to imagine that the enemy here is out in the flat plain.
Okay, I'm going to stop it right here because they both just said imagine twice in a row. And yeah, that's exactly what I think this is. The figment of someone's very impressive imagination. You know, I can't figure out how to really think about all this stuff. You know, I'm sort of torn by two different ideas. So I guess you'll know where I land by the title I eventually give this episode. But on the one hand, this is an extreme case of myopia, a limited or restricted vision. Now you can see the immense accomplishments of the people who built the mounds, who built the Mexican pyramids, but you can't see past your own predetermined conclusions. It's an epidemic, really, and I suffered from this myopic way of viewing the world as much as anyone ever did. But once I realized what I was doing, I just couldn't sustain it. I guess this leads me to my second point here, because this is such a terrible case of cultural imperialism.
Cultural imperialism.
Now, when you're so myopic that you can only see these amazing ancient cultures as a validation of your own religious beliefs and biases, then you're essentially robbing these people of their own essence, their own accomplishments, and their own identity. Now, I actually came to really hate this about the church, and especially about my mission. I spent 2 years in Japan, where I could have been really learning and absorbing the Japanese culture. I could have been appreciating it for what it is and learning what it has to teach me. Instead, I was a cultural imperialist. I only pretended to care about Japanese culture in those areas where I could force parallels to Mormonism, only in those areas where I could build on common beliefs and get them to where I wanted them to go. And in Japan, for a lot of us missionaries and members alike, that meant reinterpreting Japanese history to fit this restoration model, to view the Japanese as the lost tribes of Israel, to rob them of their own tradition and their own heritage and impose another culture on them, and claim that it was their original culture all along, now newly restored.
Something incredible, I'll do something incredible.
The missionaries can be so presumptuous.
I want to be the Mormon who changed all of mankind. My best friend.
And so woefully naive and well-meaningly arrogant.
I'll do something incredible that blows God's freaking mind.
Now, I mentioned a few weeks ago that the missionaries came to my door as I was recording the Untestimony minisode. What I didn't tell you was that they handed me some reading material. It was something that, as a folklorist, I recognized right away as Xerox lore. Now, we had a version of this in my mission. It was a first discussion written by some anonymous Japanese missionary who explained all the parallels between the Japanese people and the lost tribes of Israel. It had been Xeroxed over and over and passed from missionary to the point where it was fading. The ink was fading in spots. And that's exactly what I saw when I looked at this letter that the missionaries handed me. Now, this is supposedly a talk given by a guy who was a lawyer, presumably sometime in the 50s or the 60s, because he mentions the church being 2 million strong and that David O. McKay was a prophet at the time. But he claims to explain why the church is true from the point of pure logic. And the missionaries gave this to me because they apparently loved it and thought that it would show me the error of my ways in an academic way that a guy like me could really appreciate. Now, remember, naive and well-meaningly arrogant, because this letter is full of the same myopic, cultural imperialist pseudo-proof that we see everywhere supporting the truth claims of the church. Want to hear it? Well, too bad, because I'm sharing it with you anyways.
Why I Am a Mormon by Douglas Bryan.
Now, like I said, this Douglas Bryan guy, I don't really know who he is. I Googled him. I didn't find anything. I think maybe it's because it was the 50s or the 60s. But the only reference that I did find to this essay was on a missionary's homepage, some kid that had served in Brazil maybe 2007, 2008. So, you know, I got it in Indiana. Somebody's using it in Brazil. It's been around since the 50s or 60s. It's a pretty good example of the Xerox lore thing. So anyway, Douglas Bryan, lawyer. All right, what do you got to say?
I would like to tell you why I am a Mormon from the standpoint of pure logic.
Wow, pure logic. Okay, as opposed to other kinds of logic. So I guess logic is the use of valid reasoning, and reasoning is the process of establishing and verifying facts to support your claims. And pure means that it's not mixed in with anything else. So the claim right off the bat is that we're about to see a valid reasoning that's not mixed with anything other than verifiable facts. Let's see how we do.
I realize that it takes prayer and faith and many things to get us into the church and keep us there, but my faith can be much stronger if it's backed up by some good, sound logic. To begin with, I am a Christian. I believe in the mission of Christ. I believe the story of Christ in all its details as told in the Bible. But I can't prove it. So far as I've been able to learn, the regular historians who wrote in the actual day in which Christ lived didn't mention his name. There are those who challenge this and cite the writings of Josephus, but Josephus didn't live in the time of Christ. He was born several years after Christ was crucified. So, if I lay aside Christian writings and Christian theology, I can't really prove that he was ever born.
Wow. You know, my dad was a lawyer, is a lawyer, and this reminds me so much of conversations with him. I don't really know what to say. Okay, so, all right, you can't prove that Christ was born. I'll give you that. No problem there.
I have here a copy of the Book of Mormon. If I can prove that Joseph Smith was a prophet, if I can prove that he received the way he said he received it, if I can prove that this book is true, then I will not only prove that we have the true gospel, but I will prove the story of Christ, because this book contains the story of Christ.
Yeah, you know, I can see why this would be appealing to the missionaries, because if you can prove that Joseph Smith was a prophet, or prove that the Book of Mormon is true, then you can prove the divinity of Jesus Christ and everything that says about it. Yeah, I can get that. So is that what we're trying to do here? We're trying to set out to prove that Joseph Smith is a prophet and prove that the Book of Mormon is true. All right, I'm going to open up my mind. Give me the proof. Let's evaluate it.
At the time Joseph Smith brought forth the Book of Mormon, he was just 23 years old. In order to get the true picture, try to think of some young man you know who is 23 years old.
Whoa, wait a second. I thought this was going to be pure logic. This doesn't seem like pure logic to me. You know, we're making a comparison to a 23-year-old in the 1950s or 60s compared to Joseph Smith as a 23-year-old. I mean, okay, mind open.
He has been to school just 3 years. Try to think of some lad who has been to school just 3 years. Now, when a man writes a book of this type, he usually travels thousands of miles and spends years in research before he attempts it.
Really? A book of this type? Thousands of miles? You've already lost me, Brother Bryan.
The man who wrote The Robe spent 10 years in research before starting, and it didn't even need to be true. It just had to sound like it was true.
Okay, a quick Google check shows that The Robe is a fictional story that was published in 1942 about a Roman tribune and his Greek slave who were involved in the crucifixion of Christ. It was written by a man named Lloyd Douglas, an American minister born in Columbia City, Indiana, and he got the idea for The Robe from a fan named Hazel McCann, who wrote a letter asking Douglas what he thought happened to Christ's garments after the crucifixion. Now, I didn't find anything in that article about 10 years of research or even traveling thousands of miles to write it. He wrote 10 novels from 1929 until his death in 1951, and The Robe was the ninth of these 10. So The Robe is really just some weird red herring that he's throwing out here. It's being used as a benchmark to measure by comparison how impressive the Book of Mormon is, but seriously, pure logic? This is pretty sloppy stuff.
Joseph Smith didn't travel anywhere except around his neighborhood with a horse and buggy.
Really? So you don't count the time that he spent in Salem when he was a little kid after that whole leg surgery thing, or the time that he spent in different parts of New York and Pennsylvania as a treasure seeker when he was taking people on expeditions of hidden treasure and gold Indian Spanish buried mine stuff? It just was around his neighborhood with a horse and buggy? Brother Brian?
He didn't do any research at all. In the first place, he wouldn't have known how. In the second place, he had no books. In his day, there were no books containing this material.
Oh, come on. Now you're just speaking from ignorance. You know, Ethan Smith had that book, A View of the Hebrews, which had some pretty similar comment. And then there was that whole, the late war between the United States and Great Britain that was written in 1816 by Gilbert J. Hunt. I mean, that reads very similar to the Book of Mormon, but I don't know. I guess you didn't know that in 1950s or 1960s, or maybe you just didn't want to know it.
When a man writes a large book like this, he has hundreds and sometimes thousands of little revisions. A word deleted here and a phrase or sentence changed there, etc. Sometimes the entire book must be rewritten several times before it's ready for publication. Joseph Smith couldn't do that. His first draft had to stand. He couldn't change one single word once it was written down. And yet the language is quite perfect.
Yeah, remember when he started saying that he was going to give pure logic, which was verifiable facts? These aren't facts. I mean, you can verify this, and you can see that there have been hundreds of changes to the Book of Mormon, even if they're small changes. But there have been changes to the Book of Mormon since Joseph Smith wrote it, so this is completely off base.
You will find no discrepancy between names and dates and places.
Well, you won't find them anymore because they've already been changed. But there was a point where King Benjamin was actually changed to King Mosiah in a spot because Benjamin had already been previously killed off at that point in the text, so they had to go back and change it. But, you know, come on. Let's get this right. Joseph Smith didn't write any of the Book of Mormon. He dictated it to scribes, mainly to Oliver Cowdery. So Joseph Smith would speak, and Oliver would write, and then he'd read it back, and they'd go over and they'd review what had been written down, and they would self-correct as they went. So, yes, it's still an impressive accomplishment, and one that would require a certain level of genius to pull off, but come on, Joseph can't be held to this impossible standard of not being able to change one single word once it was written down. That's just verifiably false.
Famous attorneys have declared that in this respect, the whole book is as perfect as the finest legal document. Any author will tell you that for even the greatest scholar to write such a thing in one draft would be absolutely and utterly impossible.
Any author, huh? Okay, so can I pick Mark Twain? Because he lived at the same time of Joseph Smith, roughly, and he read the Book of Mormon and he actually commented on it. So let's take a look at some of the things that Mark Twain said. And this comes from Roughing It, a personal narrative.
All men have heard of the Mormon Bible, but few except the elect have seen it or at least taken the trouble to read it. I brought away a copy from Salt Lake. The book is a curiosity to me. It is such a pretentious affair, and yet so slow, so sleepy, such an insipid mess of inspiration. It is chloroform in print. If Joseph Smith composed this book, the act was a miracle. Keeping awake while he did it was, at any rate. If he, according to tradition, merely translated it from certain ancient and mysteriously engraved plates of copper, which he declares he found under a stone in an out-of-the-way locality, the work of translating was equally a miracle for the same reason. The book seems to be merely a prosy detail of imaginary history with the Old Testament for a model, followed by a tedious plagiarism of the New Testament. The author labored to give his words and phrases the quaint, old-fashioned sound and structure of our King James translation of the Scriptures, and the result is a mongrel, half-modern glibness and half-ancient simplicity and gravity. The latter is awkward and constrained, the former natural but grotesque by the contrast. Whenever he found his speech growing too modern, which was about every sentence or two, he ladled in a few such scriptural phrases as exceeding sore, and it came to pass, etc., and made things satisfactory again. And it came to pass was his pet. If he had left that out, his Bible would have been only a pamphlet.
No fair. Mark Twain's not a good example. He didn't say anything good about the Book of Mormon.
This book contains not only the fullness of the everlasting gospel, but many other wonderful things that were not known at the time it was published.
Has anyone else noticed that Douglas Bryan's voice has kind of started sounding a little bit like a bad Al Gore impersonation?
I wonder how that happened.
You will find principles of social science and political science more advanced than was taught in the universities of Joseph Smith's day. You will find in this book approximately 180 proper and new names. I think that no author in all history ever created 180 new names. The mighty Shakespeare created about 50 in his lifetime. Joseph Smith didn't take a lifetime. This book, from beginning to end, required slightly more than 10 weeks. From the time the first word was written down until the book was complete and perfect was about 71 days.
Well, it's true. There are about 188 proper names that are unique to the Book of Mormon, but there's also 140 names that it shares in common with the Bible. And, you know, I don't know how many of those 188 are actually Iha or Oni or Ha or Wuhiha variants of those 149 biblical names, and I'm not going to go through and count them. I also don't really want to take the time to compare the Book of Mormon to the Lord of the Rings, but it is interesting to note that because the Lord of the Rings purports to be a translation of the Red Book of Westmark, that the English language version is just a representation of the original Western, or possibly the Reformed Western, but translations of the Lord of the Rings into non-English languages have needed to find ways within those languages to imitate the complex interplay between English and Elvish nomenclature in the book. Now, an additional difficulty is with the proper names in Old English, like the names of the Rohirrim, or the Old Norse, you know, the external names of the dwarves, because their relation to English within the history of English and of the Germanic languages more generally and respectively is intended to reflect the relation of the purported original names of Westeros. Yeah, that Lord of the Rings book is so complicated that, it must be true. Now, granted, Tolkien took considerably longer to write it than 71 days, but then again, so did Joseph Smith.
You would find it a formidable task to even copy it in 71 days, to say nothing of composing it. The very manner in which it was produced is proof enough for me of its authenticity.
Yeah, but Douglas, you missed so many points here and misrepresented so many facts that I'm starting to think that you're kind of an idiot.
So if I'm to risk my eternal salvation on it, I must be very sure. So I will lay aside these points for a moment. Joseph said he got this book from some gold plates that were shown to him by an angel. Gold, no less. Now, if he had said brass or stone or something, it would have been easier to believe. But solid gold? However, upon investigation, I find that gold was a common commodity in the place where the plates were written.
Gold doesn't show up in any way until 700 or 800 A.D.
That is what the Spanish conquistadors were after in the early days. You perhaps remember the old chieftain who was captured. Standing in a large room, he placed his hand high on the wall and said, "I will fill this room up to there with gold if you will release me." It took him only a few days.
What the hell is he talking about?
Gold is malleable and easily pounded into thin sheets. It's easy to write upon and doesn't corrode. I can't imagine a more perfect material upon which to make a permanent record.
Okay, Douglas Bryan, so the limits of your imagination are now equivalent to pure logical evidence. Is that kind of where you're going with this?
Joseph said he translated these plates by means of a Urim and Thummim. That is an ancient instrument mentioned in the Bible. It contains two clear stones held together in a frame somewhat like our eyeglasses. When he looked through these stones, he could read this ancient language. As a schoolboy would probably express it, that was a big hairy story if I ever was one.
Big hairy story.
But do you ever hear a physicist explain the Urim and Thummim?
No, have you?
He says it's not unscientific in any way.
Wow, well, golly heck, I will take the unnamed physicist's opinion as kind of my gold standard. Holy cow, this nails it. And this is a great example of pseudo-witness, which is kind of a big red flag for folklore, but anyway.
He expects the time will soon come when we can actually make one. In fact, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology right now, they are perfecting an electronic instrument that will translate one language into another.
Right. You've all got the Urim and Thummim app on your iPhones, right?
Joseph said that the language of the plates was Egyptian. Egyptian stuff in America? People hooted at the idea. But since that time, they have found Egyptian artifacts by the thousands, all the way from obsidian stone coins to pyramids as large or larger than those in Egypt. Did you ever see a diagram of the inside of a pyramid? It is the most complex labyrinth of halls and ramps and stairs, etc., that you can imagine. There is a strange thing. The pyramids in America and those in Egypt are built just alike, outside and inside. Joseph Smith couldn't have known a thing like that.
Well, first of all, that's not true. They aren't identical. But, you know, even if they were, where in the Book of Mormon does it talk about the insides of pyramids being compared to the Egyptian pyramids? Like, how would Lehi's family, the Nephites, know how to build pyramids? I mean, is it the Mulekites that did it, or is it the Jaredites that came over before the Egyptians built the pyramids? I mean, like, if you think this through a little bit, you know, okay, I'll save it to the end.
There were 63 gold plates. The original copy of the Book of Mormon contained 588 pages. Some editions with larger print contain more than 750 pages. How could he get 750 pages from 63 plates? Some of our scientists, Sojal for instance, have made a gold plate of the same size, and with the cuneiform writing, have written 12 pages of the Book of Mormon on one gold plate. If you multiply 63 by 12, the answer will startle you.
It's 756, which is exactly the same number of those Books of Mormon that happen to have, like, extra large print. How could Joseph Smith have possibly known what font size they would be using? Amazing! I'm startled.
Now, these points are perfect. I feel sure that they would stand up under the scrutiny of a court of law. But I think I will lay them aside also. I think we can find a better one. In this book, it mentions horses several times. And the time it was published, historians agreed that there were no horses in early America, only those that had been brought over a few years before the Spaniards. But many years after the book was published, they began to find in the tar pits of California and the quarries of the Dakotas evidence of horses.
Nope.
Skeletons of horses.
No. Nope.
Pictures of horses.
Nope.
Hunters on horses.
No.
Hogs on horses. Lots of horses.
No.
Joseph Smith couldn't have known that.
And he didn't.
In this book, it says that because of a dearth of timber in certain areas, that many things were made of fine cement. Now, at the time this book was published, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, there was no workable cement in the world anywhere.
Why do I just not trust him here?
But since that time, they have found 4,500 miles of cement roads. They have found aqueducts and temples and, in fact, whole cities made of the finest kind of cement. Joseph Smith couldn't possibly have known that. In this book, it says that at the time Christ was crucified, there was a great upheaval similar to the one in the Holy Land. So great was the disturbance that many whole cities sank beneath the temple. In Joseph Smith's day, you couldn't prove a thing like that. There was no way to know. But when we learned to fly, we could see things in the ocean that could never be seen before. Just as late as our war in Korea, some of our pilots spotted the 16th city lying beneath the sea.
Yeah, I have no idea what he's talking about here.
These points are perfect. They are undebatable. They can't be explained away. But I believe I can find a still better one.
Now, I just want to give you fair warning here. You know, Douglas Bryan has given some really, really weak examples to support his thesis here, but what he's about to say here is just, like, incredible. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up.
This book tells a story of some people who landed in America, about where Chile is today. They came up across a narrow neck of land and built a mighty civilization. They built roads and cities. They had wars and contentions and all the things that go with the struggles of a civilization. As the people of the Lord traveled farther and farther north, they gradually dwindled out until their last record was buried in a hill called Cumorah. At the time this book was published, historians were quite in agreement that the civilization on this continent started in the north, where they came across the Bering Strait. But since that time, they have discovered that they did land about where Chile is. They have recently been floating rafts across to show how the people got here. They did come up across a narrow neck of land. They did build a mighty civilization. We have found the roads. We have found the cities. We have found the great battlegrounds. The people did dwindle out as they came farther north, right up to the hill Cumorah. And what do you think we find just beyond the hill Cumorah? Nothing. Could a man guess 2,000 years of detailed history and get it right? One woman in her book said that Joseph Smith started to write a history of the Indians and just by chance wrote the Book of Mormon. Now, she may know a lot of things, but the law of chance certainly isn't one of them. Here's the way the law of chance works. If I number 10 little discs and stir them up in my pocket and then draw them out one at a time, my chance of getting number 1 first is 1 in 10. My chance of getting 1 and 2 in their order would be 100, etc., until my chance of drawing those 10 little discs out in their order would be only 1 in 10 billion. And yet she calmly states that all those thousands of details of history just fell into place by chance. That is the most fantastic, preposterous statement I ever heard. If Joseph Smith could have written a book this size in 1 second, just one tick of the clock, and if he could have continued to write one every second, day and night, never stopping, and if he had begun 1,000 years before Christ was born, he still couldn't have written this book by chance. So we have our point. We have found our perfect proof. He couldn't have written this book by chance in countless billions of tries. And he couldn't have written it by knowledge at all, because the knowledge it contains was not yet in the world, except in those gold plates.
Yeah, okay, I won't belabor the point any further, but just think about this. This piece of crap letter that I think was supposed to be a talk that was given in sacrament meeting. You know, this ridiculous, easily falsifiable piece of poop is being passed around right now by missionaries living right in my hometown who don't even bother to look up what they're handing out to people. Are you kidding me? I mean, you should have seen how proud and eager this kid was when he handed it to me. He really thought that this was just a bulletproof argument. I mean, sure, put 10 numbered coins in your pocket and try to pull them all out in the proper numerical sequence. How cool! What an amazing, purely logical conclusion. And, you know, honestly, if Joseph Smith had actually been right about even half of the things that Douglas Bryan mentions in this talk, it would have been pretty impressive, but no, he wasn't, and it's not. And these poor missionary kids, they don't know it. And no one's going to tell them, and they wouldn't listen even if someone did. I gave him a pretty good explanation of why I've come to see the church the way that I do, and at the end of it, they just shook their heads, and they asked me how I felt after all that I had said. And I said that I felt pretty good, and I asked them how they felt. And they said that they felt terrible, because the Spirit wasn't there. Yeah, they weren't getting any warm fuzzies from the way that I explained the deconstruction of my own beliefs, beliefs that they held and cherished. And what I wanted to say to them was, duh, which is exactly how I felt as I was walking through Teotihuacan and looking at the art and the sculptures in the museum and wondering how in the world anyone could really look at these feathered serpent images of Quetzalcoatl and think that they were looking at some bastardized survival of Jesus Christ. You know, because Quetzalcoatl was supposed to be this white god that visited them and then left and told them that he'd come back someday, and Jesus Christ visited them and then he left and he said that they'd come back someday, so Jesus Christ and Quetzalcoatl must be the same person. Because heaven forbid two completely unconnected civilizations create a mythos independent of each other with similar motifs. Because if you have a temple of the sun and a temple of the moon, then you must also have a temple of the stars somewhere, because that's how we understand the degrees of glory. And it's not like unconnected people in different parts of the world can look up at the same sky and see the same bright light in the daytime and the same lesser night in the nighttime and use those as symbols in their completely separate religious traditions. And if you have a Quetzalcoatl temple with four smaller structures on the right and on the left and in front of it, totaling 12, and then three similar structures in the back, that has to represent the 12 apostles and the first presidency, because, you know, 12 and 3 aren't numbers that anyone else would possibly place any completely separate meaning into, and it's not like they were possibly meant to total 15 in the first place, because 15, that just doesn't make any sense. Not to us. And we're the ones with the truth of all things. It's insulting. It's myopic. It's culturally imperialistic. And it's just the way it is when your brain has been shaped and formed through years of primary and Sunday school and seminary as a product of the Mormon belief machine.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Too late. Turns out, I took that red pill a long time ago in very small, teeny tiny bites. And now I can't untake it, no matter how badly I might want to. But I don't really want to. I couldn't go back and live in that Mormon matrix world again, where Masonic rites are thought to date all the way back to Adam, and ancient submarines brought the Jaredites and honeybees to America, and poisonous serpents separated the people of the North from the lands of the South, and the brother of Jared is named Mahanrai Moriankamer. I've tried. I'm just too cynical. And with apologies to Douglas Bryan, too purely logical. It's sort of like that Supertramp song.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. But then they sent me away to teach me how to be sensible, logical, oh, responsible, practical. Then they showed me a world where I could be so dependable, oh, clinical, oh, intellectual, cynical.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Yep, there really are times when all the world's asleep and the questions run so deep for such a simple man. Because for as arrogant and certain as I may sound when I'm mocking the stupidity of guys like the Nephite Explorer and Brother Douglas Bryan Esquire, the truth is, I'm really only taking aim and shooting down those shadows of my old self. Because I don't really know much of anything for certain anymore, except maybe that I don't know much of anything for certain. And that I never, ever want to be that myopic and culturally imperialistic ever again. But looking back, I can see that that splinter was there in my mind, driving me mad, even as a missionary. Because there was that one P-Day back in July 1992 where a few of us started this silly little movie that we never actually finished.
I want to tell a story.
No, not tonight, Christopher.
Your mom said no.
But I want to tell a story, Dad.
It's all right, Mr. Crispins. We'd love to hear a story.
Okay. I'm going to tell you two about my favorite superhero, but you have to guess who it is.
Will you give us a hint?
His name starts with an N.
Oh, I see. It must be Nephi.
Nephi? Nephi's dumb.
Who is it?
It was Anna Jones. Now, I based that on a real experience I had before my mission with a 5-year-old kid who did that very thing. I just took it a step further and turned it into a missionary P-Day movie. Inna Anna Jones and the Quest for the Gold Plates.
We're missionaries from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
It is called the Book of Mormon. This book was translated from some golden plates.
Wait. I'm an archaeologist.
By the way, I'm Dr. Jones. Now, what was this that you were saying about golden plates?
So, move over, Brian Fisher. You weren't the first Inna Anna Jones of Book of Mormon geography. Because golden plates, man. Golden plates. So, you see, even as a missionary, some splinter inside of my mind knew, even then, how silly this all really was. Which is probably why I took the path that I took and developed my interest in all those weird, funny stories I heard in my mission, turning that into a formal study of Mormon folklore and pursuing that into graduate school and learning to think more clearly and critically and how to search for actual evidence and let that shape me rather than me shaping it. And yeah, that small splinter is a big reason why I am who I am today. And now you know the rest of the story. So I want to thank you for listening to the podcast. 2014 has been a pretty good year for us so far. You know, since January, since even our last listener feedback episode, our weekly downloads have almost tripled. A lot of that comes from the Tom Phillips episodes, and I think a lot of it is that we've just been averaging about 2 releases a week. Hopefully we can keep up that pace, because it's fun, and we certainly have more listeners sending in their essays and contributing content than we ever have before. We've got a few of those that we're working on, and you know, we've got Brother Jake working on more projects with us, and it just keeps getting more and more fun. So if you like what we're doing, do me a favor. Log into iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and write us up a little review. You know, right now we have 64 ratings and 41 reviews. In fact, a new one just came in yesterday. This one is from Matthew George, and he says, "Very well done. Highly recommended. If you are afraid of the truth and reality, stay away. If you find that all truth is useful, you found a good podcast. You will enjoy The Quorum." Well, thank you, Matthew George. You know, I shy away a little bit from calling what we do truth and reality because, you know, I think I've said this before. We really don't take ourselves that seriously. We know that we get things wrong. We're just trying to have fun. But I'm glad you think this. So thank you very much. And as always, we encourage you to comment on our website, InfantsOnThrones.com, or like us on our Facebook page. And by all means, share us with your friends because sharing is caring, or something like that. Thanks again for listening. Anyone for the closing prayer? I said, "Why would you say they'll be calling you a radical, a liberal, or fanatical criminal? Oh, won't you sign up your name? We'd like to be your acceptable, respectable." Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
If a chicken and a half laid an egg and a half in a day and a half, how many pancakes would it take to shingle a dog's roof?
34.
Okay.
All right.